This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Can I just say from the very beginning of the show that of the top 10, the two that I still haven't seen because I was away are, so your reviews please, of Dear John and The Ghost. Those are the only two outstanding titles from the top 10, so short and pithy.
Right, you could have seen The Ghost, and you could have seen Dear John.
Yeah, I could have seen all the films that are out this week. Would you like me to list them, or would you like me to go back and retrospectively catch up on some other stuff?
Yeah, I would quite like you to see The Ghost and Dear John. Anyway,
if
you could do us a paragraph on those.
Not a paragraph, a couple of sentences.
Or a line, or a couple of words.
An adjective.
850-58-mail@bbc.co.uk. Dear Pauline and Franny, this is Robert Wilson. I've just suffered a horrendous paper cut whilst opening my latest edition of Your Manchester magazine. I nearly lost my middle digit. If this weren't bad enough, what should be on the front cover but the sinister, smirking face of the good doctor? Not only do the eyes in the picture follow you around the room, but I'm convinced that he knew that he was going to injure me when he was photographed.
I did, and in fact, when they took the photograph, what's the guy's name?
Robert Wilson, thanks for paying attention.
I said, make sure that Robert Wilson gets to see this.
And he's suffered because of that. Now, a couple of things you need to know in case you missed last week's programme. There was a lot of correspondence about translated movie titles and how that gets lost and changed and twisted. Also, there's a new game started about obvious taglines. This was because Clash of the Titans has the tagline, Titans
Will Clash.
Will Clash, which has provoked a whole raft of stuff, which we'll get to in just a moment. Chris, on this email, while on holiday in Paris, I found a familiar-looking DVD for a little-known or applauded religion-based love triangle rom-com, Keeping the Faith. A priest, a rabbi, and that woman off Dharma and Greg walk into a bar. Religion, faith, continue belief in relationships, the title works. In France, it has become called Her Name Was Anna, and had therefore lost all cleverness. Ironically, Lost in Translation's Spanish title in South America, Perdidos en Tokyo, Chinese title Michi Dong Jing and its Hebrew title Avodim Bi Tokyo all mean lost in Tokyo, meaning that the titles themselves are literally
lost in translation. Very good.
Julian Fitzgibbon, M.A. Oxon Lit Hum.
Hum?
Humanities and literature and humanities, I would think.
Oxon is
Oxford.
Yeah, Oxford. Why Oxon?
I imagine that's Latin.
Oh.
Let's dig well, this that is from hole
what, this
very
is what did
on.
The Romans ever do for us?
Julian Fitzgibbon has a big degree. He's got an MA, Oxon, Lit Hum. Dear Zeus and Hades, very much enjoyed your game of obvious taglines last week, but I'm afraid I must now spoil your fun.
Yeah.
You see, although one would expect some kind of clash between titans to go without saying, no such clash actually occurred within the film. As any person with a working knowledge of Greek mythology knows, the Titans were the generation of gods that preceded the Olympians. Far from any Titans clashing, there were, in fact, no Titans to be seen in the entire 118-minute 3D extravaganza. I think the advertising campaign might have been more intriguing if they'd come clean and used the more truthful line, contrary to expectation,
Titans won't clash.
Will not clash.
Did you know that there's a
about that?
There's a film that was distributed by Troma, the straight to video label, home of things like, you know, Teenage Nymphoid Barbarian and Dinosaur Hell and all that stuff. And they distributed.
Is that good? Shall I
no, it's out? Rubbish. There was a point when the only thing about their movies that were any good were the titles and the taglines. And they distributed a movie called Rabid Grannies, in which, as was pointed out in several reviews, they were neither rabid nor grannies. They were in fact possessed aunties. And it was a retitling of
a Belgian movie,
the original title of which was Les Mêmes Cannibales, which means apparently family cannibals.
I'm still going to dig it out because it still sounds like it might be worth it.
Rabbit Grannies.
This from Andrew McCallum. Having listened to last week's podcast and the obvious taglines, I'll just chip these in. Body of lies. There's a body of information. It's not necessarily true. Psycho. There's a man, he's not quite there, mentally speaking. This from Adam. It's the window, round the back.
Very good.
There will be fighting at a club.
But you can't talk about it.
All of which is very good. Eddie Marsden is waiting outside to come in and at least some decent kind of wittertainment.
So come up with one for She's Alice Creed, She Disappears.
Well, it's the disappearance. Yes, because the movie is the disappearance of
Elizabeth. Yeah, no, I've just done it.
I know, but that. Okay, well, that might be quite tricky. I think.
How about, here she is.
Who's this? This is Sophie. Mark and Simon, first time mailer, listen since 2005. Love you. I live in Japan and always listen at odd times, so sorry to email in the middle of the week, but you're talking about film titles in other language. Let me share these, please. I am Danish, and I find the most treacherous of all to be the films that have their English titles changed to another English title.
Okay.
Apparently what happens in Denmark.
Right.
Die Hard with a Vengeance, not in Denmark. Here it was known as Die Hard Mega Hard. You wouldn't take that seriously, would you? Cruel Intentions. No, sir. Let's give it a name so it does what it says on the tin. Thus, the Danish-English title is Sex Games. Not poetic, but it is clear. In Japan, they often keep the English title, but get rid of the annoying particles and plurals. Pirates of the Caribbean becomes Pirate of Caribbean. Lord of the Rings was Lord of Ring. Favourites, though, are the Woody Allen films, which were given Danish titles starting Mig Og X for X and Me. So why don't you quiz the doctor if he can figure out which of these films?
So Mig Og X for
X and Me,
right.
Mig Og Bogart, Bogart.
Okay,
and
that's
me.
Play it again, Sam.
Play it again. Mig Og Annie,
Annie Hall.
These are all the Danish titles. Yeah. Okay. Mig Og Fremtiden,
Mig Og Fremtiden, Husbands and Wives,
The Future and Me, or Sleeper.
Sleeper. Oh, fine, very good.
And so it goes on. I mean, the correspondence has been non-stop. 85058, hands will be flapped, as Gareth Hurley correctly points out, Cardiff Exile.
I see that Nick Clegg is coming in for a certain amount of Are Those Kermode's Hands tweeting. People are saying that Nick Clegg has got flappier hands than I have.
Is that right?
Apparently, yeah.
I didn't know. I've watched those debates. I didn't notice he had flappy hands.
Well, it's on Twitter. It's happened.
He's about to be introduced to an audience at the Crucible who are watching the snooker.
Who?
In Sheffield.
Nick Clegg.
Nick Clegg.
Is he going to do that? He's going to say, hello, I'm Nick.
Yeah, but
Clegg.
that just looks like
they
Kermit
even. You know,
the
terrible thing was, even for those not watching on the, but they heard that on the radio. This is the sound of my hands.
That's the sound.
I bet they heard it.
Of no hands flapping. We have some movie conversation between now and 4 o'clock, and that looks like Eddie Marsden. However, having watched his film this morning, that you look like a very kind of cuddly, friendly, smiley version of an evil man who I saw in a film. Hello, Eddie.
It's called acting. Hello. Simon.
Oh, right. Well, it might be acting to you, but you're a scary man, Eddie. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's always good to have you on the programme. You can come in to promote anything that you want.
That's very kind. Thank you very much. If I sell my house, can I come in here?
We're trying to think of
anything. When he says anything you want, he means specifically movie-related. Unless you make a movie about selling your house, in which case we are your first port of call.
We're trying to think of a tagline for The Disappearance of Alice Creed. But we'll be doing obvious taglines because of Clash of the Titans, which has the tagline,
Titans will clash.
So is there a tagline for The Disappearance of Alice Creed?
No, I don't think there is there? No,
there's a girl.
And it's your film. You're the one who would know.
I haven't got a clue. Disappearance of Alice Creed, starring Eddie Marsden. How about that?
That is the tagline. Starring Eddie Marsden is actually the tagline.
That is, frankly, all you need to know. And for proof of that, let me read you this from Martin in Old Portsmouth.
Yep.
So it's Eddie Marsden today, all about presumably The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which we all know will be a very good film because Eddie is in it, because Eddie is only ever in good things and is also himself only ever very good. Why is this? Does he have mystical powers? Is his acting genius and sheer magnetism enough to drag a ho-hum script and journeyman direction up to unthought-of heights? Does he have mystical powers of insight, being capable of discerning by arcane means which of the myriad scripts with which he is presented and the myriad casting directors by whom he is lobbied has that mystical something which augurs for a fine cinematographic work capable of charming the critics and gracing the multiplexes? Or is he just a spawn again? Eddie has similar powers to Tim Spall, and when they're in a film together, you get Pierpoint, which was a fabulous piece of work. Regards as ever. Anyway, I'm just reading that out to prove that we all think you have magic powers, Eddie.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
We should point out at this point that Eddie is a Kermode Award holder. Eddie won the Kermode Award for Best... Don't do that.
Why? Look impressed...
For Best Supporting Actor for...
I will if he does.
All my friends are very impressed. It's pride of place in my office.
See, most people, when they get them, keep them humorously in the loo.
But not Eddie.
Not Eddie. Apparently he keeps his in the office, which I'm very, very proud of. And there was a period on this show in which we did spend an awful lot of time going, Enraha! Enra, as a result of you, so thanks for that.
Oh, what, from Happy Go Lucky, yeah.
No, Eddie, as a result of something. Yes, of course, from Happy Go Lucky.
From just lying under a pyramid, yeah. Where you find such stuff going. As an interview, this isn't going very well because it's all Mark and me and not much Eddie. So here's the first question. Tell us all about The Disappearance of Alice Creed.
The Disappearance of Alice Creed is a kidnap thriller. It's about two criminals who kidnap a young girl called Alice Creed and hold her to ransom for £2 million. What I think is great about the film is for the first 10-15 minutes, it's a terrifying film, but you kind of think it's going to be this gratuitous kidnap genre thriller. And then suddenly there's a load of twists and turns within the story, and with every twist and turn, the story becomes more character-based, and the tension ratchets up with every twist and turn, and I think it's a really good film. It's only three people in one location. There's nothing but the acting, really, and the writing and the directing, so it stands on its own, and it's getting a very good response.
Shall we play a clip? We do have a clip.
Well, that would be quite a good point to play one.
Okay, so the story is that Eddie and another guy have kidnapped Alice Creed.
Well, you just said that.
Would you like to set the clip up?
I don't know what the
clip is. Do you see what I have to contend with? You think acting is hard. I have to do a show under these circumstances.
Eddie has just already said what the story is.
Fine, here's a clip.
Rennie, tell me something. Why did you choose her?
I didn't choose her. You chose her.
Yeah, but you suggested her. Why?
You know why? I read about her in the newspaper. What's this all about, Vic?
Just something doesn't feel quite right.
What do you mean?
I mean, just now. She was acting funny.
Why, what did she say?
Say? Why would you think she'd say anything?
I don't... You said she was acting funny.
Yeah, but I didn't say she'd said anything. What could she say? What do you think she would say?
I was getting nervous halfway through that because I was thinking, I don't want it to explain anything.
Yeah, no. May I say, before we go any further, in the press notes, there is a thing from the director, Jay Blakeson, which says very specifically, thank you for coming to see my film. This is a gentle plea asking that once you've seen the film, refrain from writing about, or in this case, talking about the plot twists. I hope you'll agree that for maximum enjoyment of the film, it works best if certain events within the film are kept under wraps. So I'm just reading that out in advance, because the last time we had the star of a movie on, I asked them a question and they pretty much told us the whole plot, including the end. I'm sure you wouldn't do the same, Eddie.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Eddie can say whatever he wants
to say. No, he
can't.
No, because it is, it's one of those things, and this is going to be slightly difficult. One of the difficult things about talking about Disappearance of Alice Creed is not one wanting to give anything away,
yeah.
So just tread carefully.
I will do.
Yeah.
I will do.
Okay, well, let's talk about, you mentioned the first 10-15 minutes, which have to be, I think, some of the creepiest opening sequences to a film I've seen in a long time. And to the extent that I was thinking, well, I know it's got Eddie in it, I'm not sure I want to, if it's going to be like this, this is all really rather horrid and I don't want to stay to the end. It quickly, you establish the characters and you think, okay, I'm engaged with the story. But just explain what happens in that opening 10-minute sequence, because I think you can give that away.
No one speaks. No one speaks for 13 minutes. And basically the two criminals, myself and Martin, played by myself and Martin Comston, we just construct the lair where we hide Alice Creed. We make it soundproof, we construct the bed, everything we need to keep her locked up. It's so meticulously filmed and constructed. I don't know whether Jay has done it in real life, but it's marvellous. And also we walk around a DIY store, which looks really frightening for some reason. I don't know why. It's just basically, we don't say anything, but it's very clear that we're meticulously planning something and we're going to be really ruthless. And I think that's where the tension comes.
So the 10 minutes, Mark, what did you think when you were just watching those opening...
Well, it was really
sequences.
Interesting because, I felt very similar to you. I know, actually, often in these cases, you are more squeamish than I am. I felt really uncomfortable in the first 10 minutes of the movie. I should say off the bat, I do like it very much. But the first 10-15 minutes, I thought, I don't know where this is going, and I don't, because I specifically hadn't read about it, because I specifically knew that it was one of the films which everyone had said, if you see it, don't read anything about it in advance. So I had specifically stayed away from it. And I did get that really creep, because the way that opening is played is done in such a way as to imply that you're in a different genre of movie, that you're in a movie which is going to be leery, that is going to be nasty, that is going to be... I mean, actually, there is, I think, a clear inference that we're in Saw territory,
exactly.
You know, exactly that kind of territory, which I have really very little tolerance for, very little time for. And then, as the film develops, as you quite rightly say, with each new development, it becomes more and more character-based and becomes a different film. But it's quite brave to have gone that far in the beginning, because it is so off-puttingly creepy.
Well, playing a character was like, playing a character of Vic, without giving too much away, but he's a character, when you see him at the beginning, you think that he is so driven, that what he's trying to achieve must be, to a certain extent, purely financial. Mm-hmm. And then as the film develops, you realise that he's trying to achieve something else. And that, for me, as an actor, is fascinating to do, because I know within the first 10, 15 minutes of the film, I can be as ruthless as I want to, because I know there's going to be a payoff at the end.
We should say that the film is a... do they say Cine Manx or Cinema NX now, production?
I think it's Cinema NX.
Means
Cinema
NX. Art of Man production.
Well, yeah. why didn't you just say
because
it?
No, because they're now referred to as Cinema and then NX at
it's
the
Cinemanx,
end. It used to be Cinemanx, but yeah. They're now it's sort of Cinema NX. So tell us how fabulous it was working in the Isle of Man, Eddie, bearing in mind that my family's from there, so be nice about it.
Well, it's just a lock-up garage, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be anywhere. Sure.
Well, I tell you what, I've done three films with Cinema NX in the last 3 years. So I did Awesome World, me and Awesome Worlds.
Yeah,
Philip Ridley's Heartless and this, and I get on very well with them. You know, they're a very small company, they've all got kids, and so whenever I do a film with them, they let me fly off home for the weekend, and I trust them. You know, there's a lot of dodgy people in this film business, and the guys who run Cinema NX aren't. They're very trustworthy. They try and make good movies. They always get them out, and they look after their artists.
And that is a really good trio of films, because me and Orson Welles, which I went to the Gaiety premiere of it, which I really like that film, which is now, I think, on DVD.
Yeah, it's coming out now, yeah.
Through Tesco's, I think, only. And the Philip Ridley film, Heartless, which I finally saw just last week, and I know it's coming out 21st of May because it's been around for a long time, but I was really knocked out by that. I mean, I'm a huge Philip Ridley fan, although I think they're finding it very difficult to position it. But I think it's that's true, though, isn't it? They don't know how to sell that.
No, because Philip doesn't fit in any genre. He's his own man. He's a big hit. I mean, I was born literally two streets away from him. So when they asked me, do you want to do a Philip Ridley film, I just jumped at the chance. Because I think he's a great artist, you know. I wish there was more. The East End was acknowledged the more the artists in the East End rather than the gangsters, to be honest with you.
Can I ask you a bit more about what you just said in that last answer you were talking about? There are a lot of rotten people in the film industry. What did you mean by that? Is that more so than you'd find in the, you know, car insurance business? I mean, what is it? Presumably, you've come up against these people.
Well, what I think it is in this industry, is there's people with a lot more ambition than ability. And because you have the payoffs are great. If you make it successful in the film business, the payoffs, both psychologically and financially, are enormous. So you get people grabbing for it a lot of the time. But you get certain people. The best example for me of the best producer I ever worked with was Simon Channing Williams, who died last year and was Mike Lee's producer. It wasn't until I worked with him that I suddenly realised what a producer does. When anybody does any job, the less egotistical they do the job, the better they do it. And I found that with Simon, and I do find that with the guys from Cinerama NX. You know, they're secure in their business. The business is running well, so therefore they don't grab at things. It's the kind of people who has, like, as I said, have more ambition than ability, really. We've all got ambition, but you should work at your trade more, really. And my fingers have been burnt a couple of times.
That's very interesting stuff. Number of people suggesting taglines for your film. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore has come in.
That's very good.
Apologies to Martin Scorsese. Fraser Kemp is suggesting, she was there, and yes, then she wasn't. What do you think?
That's a good one.
Andy Mayo, no relation. Now you see her, now you don't. None of these really convey the spirit of the film, though, do they? They'd make it some like kind of heist movie, which it isn't. Anne in Warwick, I worship at the altar of Eddie Marsden, truly not worthy. Martin on the M1, could you tell Eddie Marsden that I think his performance in Happy Go Lucky is one of the best I've ever seen? The crack up scene is awesome. I think maybe then if we need to try and unpick a little bit about the film, which, as you've already mentioned, is difficult because of the reveals that tumble out once you get beyond a certain point. Can you explain a bit more about your character then? Because he is sort of in charge, isn't he? I mean, you also appear to be the more volatile of the two.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're running the show.
Yeah, Vic met the character of Danny, played by Martin Compston. We met in prison, and Vic's been in prison for like 13 years. And when he comes out, they've planned it in prison, this kidnap, and it's his last chance of achieving happiness, really, through this kidnapping. So he's meticulously planned it for years, and when he comes out, he's ruthless, and he's we created a backstory that he was a torturer for some kind of gangster firm when he was younger.
So do you do a lot of that backstory? So because some actors are very in favour of it, other actors not. Do you do a lot of preparation of what happened to the character off screen? Explain how that works.
Well, I can't describe it on radio, really. But if you're creating a character, if you have 5 minutes of screen time, you have to create 25 minutes of psychological processes going on in your mind. With Mike Lee, you can improvise a scene for 2 hours, and when you see it on film, he'll bring it down to 1 minute. So for me, it makes sense because you have to be... An actor's job is to create a human life, and a human life is their history and their aspirations, but they're both together. One and you know, you create their insecurities, you create their dreams, you create all this through a past life, and it has to be conducive and logical to the script.
And do you have to find a connection with the character? I asked that specifically because, as Simon says, at the beginning of Disappearance of Alice Creed, your character is really terrifying and unpleasant. And similarly in Heartless, the character that you play is this kind of demonic envoy who is, you know, I mean, do you have to find a part of them that you can, you know, sympathise with and empathise with?
Well, we've always taught that nothing human is alien to me. That's what an actor should begin with. Because our job isn't to judge people, it's to portray people. Then we allow the audience to judge, you know? So I can sympathise with all these people. I don't sympathise with their methods, but I can sympathise with their aspirations.
And when you're making such a tight film, which I imagine had a small budget, and as you mentioned, there's just the three of you, and it's very intense, it's quite a disturbing film. Is it like that when you're filming? I mean, there's some... you're all in there, you're all in this together. It must be a tense film, mustn't it?
The first week was awful because that was the scene where when we capture Alice, we tie her down, and it's very degrading for the
character.
She's
kicking and fighting.
Yeah, she's kicking and fighting, and we cut her clothes off and we tie her down, and there's terrible scenes where she has to go to the toilet and she's going to have to do it in buckets and things. And it was awful, and we had to go through that for the first week, and it was shot in chronological order. And by the time we got that finished, Gemma was very stoic, and she's a brave young girl, and there was a kind of trust between the actors that once we got through that, because we all hated it, we hated doing it. Once we'd done it, then suddenly we could fly with the rest of the stuff, and I think the film benefited from it.
It is reassuring to hear that you hated it as much as we hated watching it, because it is really tough.
Oh, it's,
you know,
awful! It's awful, and I've never seen a crew more uncomfortable.
Really?
You know, yeah, really uncomfortable. Just you turn it, you know, every time we finish a take, someone would have to put a sheet over Gemma, you know, and we'd all turn away. And
this is Gemma Arterton, isn't
it? Yeah, and then, you know, she went through, it was awful. She went through a hell of a lot.
Could it not have been done in a different way then, if it was that disturbing to everybody?
I don't know, really. I mean, it's not gratuitous. I always judge things. I think, is this serving the film? And it does serve the film, and it's logical, and it's not gratuitous. And you know, and we were very, very respectful of her, and very sensitive to the situation when we were filming it.
On the tube coming in, there's a huge poster. I watched it this morning, and on the tube, it's got an 18 certificate, which I wasn't quite sure. It was sort of must have been borderline 15, 18, but it says it has an 18 for very strong language and very strong sex. And did I miss something, Mark? I mean,
I'm going to have to print out the report because that sounds odd.
I don't remember that. Did I nod off at
no,
that point?
No.
Well, let's ask Eddie. It's his film. Is there strong sex in this film? Because I missed it.
No, I think the opening 10, 15 minutes, there's the scene where we tie it down.
There's
terrible violent nature of that, yeah.
Have an 18 certificate because of the length. Oh, beg your pardon. That for the length of time that it takes for that sequence.
Yeah.
That uncomfortable feeling that everyone is going to have, and which we have while we're watching that film. That is why it will have been given an 18.
I would think that's right. But whilst you're doing the trial, I will print off the BBFC report.
While I'm doing the news.
Yes, while you're doing the news, Simon. Yes, I know you're not actually doing the news.
Justine will do the news.
Yes. You're particularly chippy with me today. What is it?
So while that is happening, you're going to check that out.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. Shall I go and do it now?
Yeah, you do that. And Ian Hart.
I'll be back in a minute.
Okay. And Ian Hart can come in because we're going to be talking about his movie as well. Not only can you listen to it, I think we're being live streamed as well, so you can watch the pictures as well and what pictures they show, because they'll show you Mark looking very dapper because he's been doing TV this morning. You've got Eddie who's looking a bit scruffy, to be perfectly honest, but he just thinks it's radio, so that's all right.
I always look like this.
Well, sometimes if you're in rockabilly style, sometimes you'll be in sort of 1950s Americana.
I mean, like I'll be in Belfast tomorrow. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, sometimes. And then off to the left there, it's the one and only Ian Hart. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm fine. I've never seen Mark look anything other than perfect.
There you go.
In his attire.
How about that? And then off to the right, Kyle Ward, who is starring in A Boy Called Dad. He is the boy who is, in fact, the dad. Hello, Kyle. How are you?
I'm fine.
It's nice to see you again because you were part of our live show. In fact, you were just...
Dragged down from the audience, I seem to remember, in Edinburgh.
In fact, the tagline for A Boy Called Dad...
He's a boy. He's called Dad.
Guess what? He's a dad.
You know, that's... Hey!
So the tagline... The only other tagline we've got for the disappearance of Alice Creed is... And there she was. Gone.
Very good.
How about that?
Can I read you this BBFC thing since you brought it up?
Yes, this is because The Disappearance of Alice Creed has an 18 certificate, yeah.
The reason, consumer, it contains very strong language, strong sex, violence and threat, and it says the strong sex and threat is particularly evident in scenes where Alice is threatened by captors and forced at the very beginning. Although as the film progresses, the relationship between the characters becomes the focus of the drama. In these scenes, in the early part of the film, there is more focus on the distressing ordeal Alice is put through, shown in a way intended to shock and unsettle the audience. The sexualised tone of the threat, towards Alice goes beyond the guidelines at 15. Then it says another issue of strong violence in a later sequence, but that's what it is. So it's relating to the tone of those early scenes, which was pretty much what Eddie was saying, that those scenes are designed to shock and unsettle, and indeed they do just that.
So does that sound about right to you, Eddie, that they pitched that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Have you been in an 18 certificate before?
He's been in Gangster Number One all those years ago.
Okay, I mean, well, we're going back.
Well, Gangster Number One, I remember being told in advance, but people saying, oh, have you seen Gangster Number One? I said, I'm never going to get through the PBFC, which, of course, is nonsense, because it wasn't a problem at all, as it seemed from it. But I remember being in the screening with Gangster Number One the first time and thinking that it was fairly full on. I really liked that film.
Yeah, it's a good film, but it was especially the bit where you're getting beat up and the camera's...
The camera is the victim. Yeah. It's a very clever scene in which there's a scene of intense violence, but it's seen entirely from the point of view of the victim. So it's basically... It's your man Paul Bettany beating up the camera, but for about 15 minutes. I mean, it's fairly long.
Have you seen?
You do some magnificent dancing in that film. There's a scene in that film when you are dancing in a front room in a way that brought to mind that quote from Four Weddings and a Funeral, referring to his boyfriend dancing. He said, "I feared lives may be lost."
Well, let's mention great dancing, and let's acknowledge that Ian Hart in A Boy Called Dad has some great moves.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's called editing, I think. It was the technique used to make that thing appear to be what it actually isn't. I can't dance to save my life.
Well, it looked pretty good.
Yeah, editing, like I say.
You had a bash.
Badovkin was very fond of it. He invented it. But
you had a bash at not dancing in This Year's Love as well, didn't you? There was a scene in which you danced very badly in that film.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, maybe sick actually. Yeah, it's all come back to me now.
Because what happened?
Get involved by having a few pints.
Because what happens
dancing.
Is you're teaching Kyle how to dance. You learn your dancing moves from Ian.
Well, kind of.
Come on, Kyle.
Well, not kind of. Yes.
Oh, that's what's happening.
If I learnt from Ian, I'd not be able to dance ever.
Come on, Kat. Just watch the film over and over again and just follow the steps. It's very easy. Just count to four. One, two, three, four. One, two. And on the offbeat, you're laughing.
I just want to see whether the licensing system works in this country. Carl, have you seen Gangster Number One?
I don't think I have.
No, well, you probably shouldn't have.
Good, That's correctly as it should be.
And you won't be going to see The Disappearance of Alice Creed, will you?
That depends. What rating is that?
It's 18.
Oh, not till next year, no. Oh,
right. Good on you, mate.
Not bad. They're all exactly the right answers that you're coming up with.
Great.
So, when you're making this film, Eddie, do you get a sense, while you're filming, you've explained how uncomfortable it all was, but did you think, while you're making a film, do you get that sense that you're onto something, that actually this is a film that people are going to instinctively go with and run with?
I think you get an idea that the essence of the film, it's a real little nugget. I think Ian agrees. Some films you they're so big that they lose direction. This was a really efficient, tight film, and because it's efficient and tight, I kind of had more faith in it than I did of some of the bigger films. Really.
There was a sense when the screenplay was first put into production, people said, "Oh yeah, it's a well written piece." And I remember being at the Orson Welles premiere in which they were talking up Alice Creed, and that apparently had been for some time on the basis of the screenplay. It was one of those things that people had from an early stage said that's a very interesting screenplay.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, when you read it, you know it's like Pierpoint was like that for me. When I read Pierpoint, I thought that's the real nugget. It's all there, you know. Jim Broadbent always says to me that you can never make a film better than the script. You know, you never think that once I get hold of it, I'll make it good. But, and so when I read Alice Creed, I thought, well, if we fulfil that as good as it's written, then we'll do a good job.
Alice Creed and A Boy Called Dad could both have been improved, I think, if they were in 3D. What do you think?
Yeah, I think all films should be in 3D. I think
A Boy Called Dad would clearly have benefited a lot.
Definitely, a lot of those landscapes would have just popped. You know what I mean? Which they failed to.
But I can't see 3D, so that'd have been pointless for me.
Well, you know, it's not all about you, Carl. It's not all about you.
It is all about me.
I was once at a Channel 4 doing in the House of Lords a couple of years ago.
A Channel 4 doing the House of Lords?
Yeah, to celebrate Film 4. And there was all that, and they sat me and Mike Lee with a load of Tory MPs.
Mike Lee was really at home.
I thought, oh, this is going to be long. And the first question this Tory MP said to Mike Lee was, "So, Mike, have you ever thought about making a film in 3D?
That's what he's missing. That's it. That's
he ought to do that as a joke. Don't you think? Hang on, just before we go in, Kyle, why can't you see 3D?
I had a lazy eye and I had an operation on it, and then just couldn't see 3D after that.
You're not missing that much, you know what I mean?
You're not missing anything at all. 3D is
apart really from your ears popping out at me.
That would be good, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Thanks, Mitch.
But he's got headphones on.
Yeah. He's seen them before, sadly.
I should say, Mike Lee making a film in 3D, I'm on record as saying that if David...
You're going to quote yourself again now.
If David Lynch ever makes a film in 3D and they show it at the Watershed in Bristol, I will go to the Watershed in Bristol and eat my shoe. And this was in honour of the fact that Werner Herzog once made a film called Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, because he had said to Les Blank, if you make a documentary, I will eat my shoe. Now the news is Werner Herzog is making a 3D film. So thanks for that, Werner, because he's like one away from David Lynch. So I'm already marinating the Dr. Martens.
So at the risk then of boring people senseless on this 3D thing, but it's always interesting running it past different people when we have either producers, directors or actors... coming in.
Or indeed sentient life forms.
Do you think we've got to the point, which is the argument, because I essentially agree with Mark about 3D, but think now that it's got to such a point where there is so much money invested in 3D and so many important people who are determined to make it happen, that actually it will happen. Well, Eddie Marsden, and then, okay, Ian volunteered to go first. Ian, you go first.
The move towards 3D television and certain vested interested parties making 3D televisions and forcing us down that line and making programmes for it, I've still got a cathode ray tube television. I didn't get a plasma screen. I didn't get a new LCD, back projected, whatever. You can still, I mean, there are still Luddites, enough Luddites, who would be offended by the fact that somebody else made a decision on their television that it had to be in 3D. I've watched the kids' videos. I think Up was in, came out as a 3D version, or one of the Pixar's.
Spy Kids 3D comes with glasses that
terrible.
You can...
Jeepers, creepers.
As opposed to the first one, which is terrific.
The first one's great. 3D version is just a load of scenes cobbled together in 3D. They forgot narrative, they forgot character development, they forgot anything resembling entertaining the children, just went for a 3D version of it. You know, it was pointless.
Eddie?
I think that's it. I think anything that becomes the heart of films is character development. And if 3D, if you sacrifice character for 3D, it will shoot itself in the foot, really.
Okay, so if either of you were offered a big budget 3D movie?
The answer is yes.
No, I'm just asking. I mean, I know, obviously, you know, the financial imperatives are, but would you do it, or would you actually say, I'm sorry, I feel strongly enough about this to not do it?
I read a script recently for a film that was in 3D. I went to meet the director. And all how he was going to use 3D, this was sounded intelligent. He said he wasn't going to compose shots so that it brought everything to the forefront of the screen. He was going to use it because it gives depth of field in certain areas, like a forest situation, the trees and the depth of those trees, and it would be able to manipulate the foreground and the background. Therefore, he had a logical reason.
Who was it?
As a filmmaker, to make it in 3D. He hadn't got his film made yet.
That's exactly.
Because
you know
I mean? He's put forward a different idea. Right. Clearly, that's going counterproductive, isn't it? But you know what I mean? I don't see that the technology necessarily is dead. There will be filmmakers who can make that technology work for them in telling their story. But if you just get a 2D film and then 3D as it so you can make more money, It's a little bit lacking.
Ken Loach, he should do one.
Yeah, he will do Defo. You'll do what a remake of Kes 3D.
Yeah, in which the Kestrel swoops as they went, come on, Kes.
Zoom. Well, you see, there are a couple of forest bits in your film. Walks through woods.
There are, yes.
Now, would that have been better in 3D?
No.
I didn't ask you, Mark. I know what you're going to say.
Ask Eddie. Go on.
There's no point to it. No, it would have been. It makes no difference. Really.
So, would you do a 3D film if you were offered one, or would you say, "I'm sorry, this is where I draw the line. It is bankrupt. It is artistically and morally bankrupt, and I shall stand no further." In the same way, do you have the same political objections to 3D that I do, which is that it is the work of the devil and has been brought here to destroy cinema as an art form as we know it?
No.
Okay. There you go. Just as long as we're clear about that, then.
This is from Sue in Aylesbury. Just come back from seeing Alice Creed. Completely blown away, totally riveting from the first minute. I must agree with the Doctor and Simon. First 10 minutes, seriously off-putting. Wondering about Vic's backstory. I'm just reading this as we go through to make sure it doesn't give anything away. Wondering about Vic's backstory. Very handy with a syringe and checks Alice's pupils after she was drugged. Was he a nurse in a past life? Eddie is fantastic, but then he is in virtually everything that he has done.
I take remove the word virtually from that sentence.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
Please.
Alex in London. I attended a Q&A with Eddie Marsden a little less than a year ago. The audience was filled with aspiring actors with a sprinkling of aspiring filmmakers, myself included. Having already experienced so many of the phonies Eddie has spoken of, it was uplifting to listen to the words of an actor. I have watched and loved and realised that, unlike so many, he makes movies out of love, not greed or misplaced desire. It was wonderful and uplifting.
I wrote that today.
Thanks, Ian. Eddie just put his head in his hands, a la Gordon Brown on Jeremy Vine.
It was like that there.
Have you got any of the emails I got? I saw that Eddie Miles in the film. He was rubbish. He wasn't all that at all.
Hey, listen, Eddie, that's enough fanfares for you. Thank you very much for coming in. Always good to have you on the show. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Now Eddie's gone, Ian, you can say what you really think about him.
I think he's great. Eddie Martin. I think he's fantastic. I don't think he's great.
And just to balance things up,
not going to get any controversy there, then, are
no,
you?
No, not at all. One of our regular correspondents, Jeremy Dillon in Sydney, Australia. Ian Hart is one of my favourite actors, and of course, the definitive John Lennon. Please ask Sir Ian what he thought of the remastered Beatles catalogue and whether he bought mono, stereo, or both. Now, this has come up on the programme before.
I bought none of them. John Sim bought me one because he's very nice. John is very, and so he bought me one. I've only got one good ear, so it's all in mono for me, pretty
fantastic.
Much.
Fantastic.
So between you and Kyle, you're kind of... Kyle's got wonky sight and you've got wonky hearing.
We could go and see a 3D movie together, but that'd be about the only
in mono
way.
And in one channel.
Exactly. I didn't bother with the revamped stereo version.
You do know that one of the most famous 3D movies of all time, House of Wax, was directed by André de Toth, who was blind in one eye, so could never see it in 3D, and he thought it looked fine.
We all knew that.
Okay, fine. We all knew that. Mention it in passing.
Now, when John Sim came on this programme, I think it was this programme, when he came on, we didn't really want to talk about Speaking in Tongues, which was the play that you were in together, which I must say, I have to say, was fantastic. Marvelous. Enjoyed it very much. He just wanted to talk about the Beatles and how you and him just talked about the Beatles the whole time.
Nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? Passes an hour or two or 3 or 4 months in John's case. I thought they were great. The album he did buy me was, you could hear the difference. You can hear the new, that there is stuff hidden or that had been hidden till it was cleaned up. But still, the melodies are the same, the songs are the same. And for people have only got one good ear, made very little difference to me.
Kyle, does he talk about the Beatles a lot while he's filming? Does he explain the Beatles to you? Giving you some Beatles albums, maybe?
No.
I'll give you a kind of...
Not that nice
once,
to me, though,
are you? No, I'll give you a lollipop. I'll give you sweets once.
All right.
It's always nice if you're working with kids to bring them sweets. You know, I think so, anyway.
Instead of a salary?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know there's no money, so you may as well have some sweets.
Okay, so Ian and Carla here because of Boy Called Dad, which we've talked about on the programme before. You look as though you're poised.
I was going to say, we have a clip, and I didn't want to go through the whole same clip confusion that happened before.
No, I
haven't heard the clip. It's you're the person who's queuing it up.
I don't know what the clip is.
We have a clip from a boy. Shall we hear it? And you can fill us in afterwards. Here's the clip.
Bleeding hell are you playing that stuff, lad? I could have killed you then.
Dad?
What?
It's me.
Who?
Robbie.
Oi! My Robbie. What are you doing, lad?
He's after me, please.
What's the score with him then?
You little sod.
Oh, what about? I want a word with you.
What's the score, Mr. Whippy, then?
New mate from Essen. Borrowed his van.
Borrowed?
We were going to give it back. Stalled it. It was liked it.
Shocking. Rule number one, if you're going to be the getaway driver, don't stall the car.
Now, this is a sequence where, Carl, you've been chased by a man in an ice cream suit.
And I think that's the only scene you're allowed to show on radio, here on radio.
Is it?
Pray tell why?
Yeah, it's most probably. Like, you know, the rest of it's got a few.
Swear words.
Yeah, well, there was a couple of swear words in that one. But anyway, we decided just to nod them through.
Oh, okay.
So just explain why you're running.
Robbie and his friends have just... a couple of weeks ago, I'd like to think so. You know, a couple of weeks ago, gone and nicked the ice cream van, and he's stalled it. The guys, the ice cream cone guys, come after him, and he's run off. And the ice cream guys just seen him again, like a couple of weeks later. So he's running off, and then sure enough, car comes and it stops. And of all the people, it's Robbie's dad, who he's not seen for. How long?
10 years, maybe.
10 years.
Yeah, that's an interesting exchange. We were sort of introducing to each other, having almost run him down.
Yeah, the great thing about that clip for me was big fans of air-cooled engines just got one of the best things I've ever heard on radio for years. In fact, there could be a whole new series of Guess the Engine.
Hang on. The bit you enjoyed the most about that, everyone else was enjoying your dialogue with Kyle, but you enjoyed the sound of the air-cooled engine.
Yeah. VW, obviously.
Obviously.
And, you know, came from a VW van.
Bulletproof.
A fantastic vehicle. I could talk about it for days. That was the flatbed version. It came in many, many versions.
Tell us more.
The minibus version, but all the same thing.
He's being ironic. He doesn't really.
I know, but I keep going with you because he's looking at me funny and he's putting me off.
No, he just looks like that, and I have to sit through this all the time. The show. Yeah.
It's like being looked at by a hawk.
Oh, thank God, somebody else has recognised this.
I feel like any day now I'm going to dive down and take my ribcage out and
in 3D.
Eat me heart.
Exactly. Can I read you Brian Percival's director's?
Where did all that come from? But here I am, just looking at Ian Hart.
I'm sorry,
you've got a very
apologies.
Creative mind, don't you?
In order to get this back on track, may I read you from Brian Percival's director's statement about Boy Called Dad? Because this is what he says about the film. I was tired of seeing gritty, northern-worthy films. Why does something have to have a point to be painful to watch? Why does something with a point have to be painful to watch? I had also made a lot of constructed drama for TV, which I enjoyed, but I wanted to do something which I felt was honest, truthful, and had integrity. I didn't want to rely on effects or an all-star cast. I just wanted a heartfelt, warm film that looked at an issue from a different perspective.
And it's like he said, exactly. Yeah. We mentioned Dave Morrissey.
That wasn't even a question.
No, I just said I was trying to get it back on track by explaining something about the film, because you had gone off in some loop about air-cooled engines and you looking like a hawk.
I apologise. I won't do that again.
I think you started it.
It's entirely my fault.
Yeah, let's talk about Dave Morrissey then.
He's not in the film, but he used to have an air-cooled engine. He had a fastback variant, Type 2, which,
Ian,
as you know, was a lovely car. Yeah.
You know when the publicist said to you, would you go on Radio 5 to talk about the film? They probably wanted you to talk about the film, just a little bit.
All right, fair enough. All right, I've been told. Kaya, what were you saying? Nothing.
He's saying, don't come to me at this point. You've lost it completely. a point to look out for. I think it's soon after that moment, one of my favourite bits in the film, just because I don't think it's ever happened in any movie ever, is where you explain the delights of Val Dunican to Kyle.
Val Dunican.
You
clearly didn't do a very good job. He still doesn't know.
We must have only done two takes on that one. Val Dunican is a lovely singer and a great wearer of cardigans. In fact, I resemble Val Dunican, not entirely. But not.
Paddy McGuinty's Goat was one.
Paddy McGuinty's Goat, do we know any others?
Walk Tall is the one that you mentioned
tall,
in the film.
Walk Tall and Look the World Right in the Eye.
That's what my mother told me when I was about
knee high. She said, son, be a proud
man and hold your head up high.
Walk tall and look the world right in the eye.
Now,
big bad dumb.
Now, do you like that in the stereo or the mono original?
I've got the stereo quad version.
Kyle, you must be thinking, what the heck is going on
here? Yeah, a bit left out over here.
Sorry, Kyle.
Well, it's your film, and he does explain Val Dunican in the film to you, but you clearly weren't paying any attention at that point. You haven't explained anything about the film at all.
No, let's talk about the
we
film.
We had cold
sorry.
Chips, though, didn't we?
Explain your relationship and what happens in this movie.
And why it's called A Boy Called Dad.
In the clip we just listened to, it was the first time these two had met. So I was an absentee father who didn't take this responsibility very seriously and absconded from the family home when he was about 3 years old. He's running away from an ice cream vendor who he's previously stolen from. And I bump into him, literally bump into him, nearly kill him in the car. And find out this stranger, who I initially don't recognise, is my long-lost son. We develop some sort of a relationship, and once again, after many, many promises of, I will do this for you, son, I will be responsible again, son, I let him down again, inevitably. At this point, he's found out that he's the father of a child, and the new partner of his girlfriend, so to speak, is not the nicest of people. And when he sees his son being mistreated, he steals his own baby son and goes on the run.
Andrew in South London says the VW flat four engine used to make a particularly great noise when you double declutched.
Happy days.
Yeah.
Memories are made of this.
How old are you? 65.
Chris Brady says it's great to hear Ian Hart in this dad role. I was at school with Ian and the McGanns, Cardinal Allen Grammar School. I was in the school plays with him, but 4 years younger. He was very serious and clever and ridiculously encouraging to me, and I thought he was godlike. It has been great to watch his career.
Ah, that's nice.
Can I just say, on the subject of everyone being...
Can I just say, that was Kyle patronising Ian.
which is a frequent...
On the subject of everyone being lovely about Ian, I did a thing on the Kermode Uncut blog in which I said, fine, write in and tell me how brilliant Ian Hart is and what your five favourite Ian Hart films are. I'm going to give you these because there's just too many to read. That's page after page. This is a typical example. This is from Ray. Been a big Ian Hart fan for ages. In no particular order, my top favourites are The Hours and the Times. He is my preferred John Lennon. Land and Freedom. Aberdeen, Hollow Road, Michael Collins. There are just, like, literally 25 pages of people saying how brilliant you are. So there we are. Rather than reading it out, take it away and put it in your scrapbook of people think I'm brilliant, which I'm sure you have.
Oh, yeah, I've got a big one of them.
Now, back to the film. Carl, I want to ask you particularly about you and the baby, because as Ian has already set up, the fact that it turns out that you're 14 in the movie and you are a dad, hence the title of the film. But there's a long sequence where you are on the run with your baby, and it would appear, although obviously this is a movie, that you're very good with this wee baby. How old was the child that you were acting with?
4 months.
About
4 months.
Was that tough? I mean, how was that for you? Because there is a sequence, particularly one particular sequence, where the baby is seriously crying, and you know, clearly you can't provoke a baby into doing that, and it's a very stressful moment in the film. But what was it like acting with a baby?
To make the babies cry, it was easy. Just didn't give them what they wanted. They wanted a lot, like, you know, they wanted feeding every 5 minutes. A lot worse than Ian was, actually.
Yeah, thanks. We had three babies. We had triplets, one of whom got big, one of whom was bigger than the other, than its two siblings, so we only had two then.
Right, so to make the babies cry, you just didn't feed them.
That is, you know, you can't say that, man. People listen to this. Oh, the next thing you know, social services.
No, they don't. Don't worry about it.
We didn't do that.
No, we didn't do that. What did we do instead? Prick them with a pin. No, come on. What was your old end of suggestion you're going to make out?
Do you have younger brothers, sisters? Nephews,
I thought you were
going to
say, do you have young kids? You nearly did say that.
Younger brothers and sisters.
I've got two sisters, and I'm in the middle, so I'm very bullied.
He looks bullied as well. He looks all put upon there just for a
moment. When we were making the film, didn't you have a new niece or nephew arrive?
I did. I had a cousin arrive.
Cousin, sorry.
Everyone's going to want you to do the babysitting, because you were so good in that film.
Yeah, and then not long later, I had a nephew as well. So
Ian, from your point of view, he acts really well with the kid, because they're difficult scenes, aren't they?
It's not everyone's, you know, I mean, not everybody has a natural affinity. Certainly not most 14-year-olds. Boys dealing with a baby and being patient. He changed the baby's nappies. He'd feed the babies. You know, he couldn't have asked. How you get that, I don't know. That was fluke. The director just cast him well. I don't think he asked him any questions. Like, oh, are you good with babies, Kyle? But it just turned out to be fortuitous. He was incredibly great with the babies. All the babies were very calm and relaxed with him.
But you have a great relationship, the two of you. I mean, it's the heart of the film.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean.
Well, that's why we're great at acting, because we look like we get on.
Is that we look like we get on? Yeah. Nice one, Kyle. Don't worry, this will be over soon. I'll be getting in the car, though. Don't you worry. Okay. Soon sort this out.
And then you'll be crying because he's not going to give you any food.
Yeah. No lollipops for you, Kyle.
Karen says, when will this be shown in Inverness? I think Kyle is brilliant, but there again, I would, as I am his mother's aunt, Karen. I'm in the Highlands, and we're very proud of Kyle. What I would like to know is how Kyle felt being so up close and personal with Sasha. Just want to explain.
Thank you very much, Aunt whom?
Aunt, which one was it?
Karen.
I don't know.
Aunt Karen.
Aunt Karen.
Have you never heard of her?
I don't know.
He's denying all knowledge of having an Aunt Karen. Go on, ask. The question was about you and Sasha.
What was the question?
Okay, have you been paying attention at all?
No.
It's your granddad's sister, apparently.
Right.
That's who it is. How did it feel being up close and personal with Sasha?
It's quite like... On set, there's a lot of people around.
Just explain who Sasha is.
It's never a comfortable... Sasha plays the mother of the baby who... we have a scene at the start of which is not CG. And on a set, it's like there's a few people there, and when they're making you like it's never comfortable doing that sort of scene around a few people, so we ended up having to stop halfway through, and then the director said go off and have a walk and you know just get a little bit more comfortable, so we had to stop halfway through and then carry on.
That's gonna be tough at the best of times, isn't it? Yeah. Even when you're used to doing that kind of thing,
doesn't bother me that.
No.
I see that's one of the only perks of the job. You don't get paid these days. You may as well get something else out of it. No, I mean, it's all. I mean, the whole thing's a technical exercise. You know, I mean, although it's like any acting exercise, you're trying to pretend that there's no one else there. You're trying to pretend that you're involved in it emotionally and in the moment. But really, it's kind of a little bit to the left a bit. And then, can we just move that lamp? It's a technical exercise. You just got to pretend.
And is that different, therefore, from... You say that the idea about having to block everyone out, because you do theatre as well.
Mm.
And presumably when you do theatre, I mean, you're in the same room with the audience. I mean, do you find that easier or worse?
Where are you going with that question?
Well, I'm less successful in that particular attempt to do... You know? I find cinema, I find television or film far more... I find it far easier, as we say, to blank everybody else. I find a relationship with a camera, which is an inanimate object, far easier than a relationship with an audience.
But it's funny just because an awful lot of actors, you know, are given to saying, oh, well, actually, you know, film and television, but actually the real work is in theatre. What's interesting about you is that you think it's the other way around. You are actually happier in front of a camera than you are in front of, but you must know that so many people say, oh, well, stage is...
People do love it, and for those who love it, I can understand, I can't really understand, but I can imagine that why they love what they do. Doing what they do, because part of that is the audience's response and the participation of the audience within that, you know, in that event. For me, when I'm working, it's entirely between me and me, or me and the other person, or me and whoever else the scene. And I understand that I'm part of a construct. The director is making the film. I'm just making sure that moment, that one little tiny bit, which is being captured by that camera in a wide shot or in a two shot or in the long shot, and I have to take into account that fact. I have to take into account what lens is on the camera. Not that it alters massively the performance, but I know how that's going to be interpreted through the lens, and therefore I have to factor that into the equation. Whereas you can't factor in 600 people in a theatre and hope that they're all going to go with you or otherwise.
And what would happen if, say, you were on stage, let's say the West End, and you're in a film, I don't know, let's just say Speeches and Tongues, for example, and someone in the audience, yeah. I don't know, maybe they were misbehaving in some way, their phone went, I don't know.
I can't imagine what would happen, the outcome of that particular series of events. Perhaps, though, knowing me, well, what did happen, as we all know, is I got really kind of irate, but I was polite enough, I felt, to wait for the end of the play. Wait till the end of the play finished, we all take the bow, everybody walks off stage, I walk off stage and speak to a member of the audience about why he might have chosen a different way of expressing himself, i.e. going to bar or leaving, if all he wanted to do was talk for 20 minutes. Now, I know you, Mark, have mentioned it in the cinema sometimes.
Drives me nuts.
Avatar, people were blogging. Five guys in a row with computers, talking to each other constantly and blogging while they're watching a film. I don't know what goes on, but...
Amazing they didn't get their computer taken away from
them. Ian, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Really appreciate you coming in. Ian, thanks very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Ian Hart. Kyle Ward, appreciate you coming in, Kyle, as well. Wish you all the best for the future. You and your family, who you're still yet to meet, by the sound of it. A Boy Called Dad is the film. Ian and Kyle, appreciate that. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks for all the emails and texts. most of which are on either Clash of the Titans or Iron Man 2 and not Iron Man 3, as was inadvertently mentioned at the beginning of the programme. Though if you do have any details on Iron Man 3, we'll look forward to that.
Yeah, there is a third one coming, apparently.
Box office top 10 we have, and we'll need some reviews of The Ghost, and we'll need some reviews of Dear John, two movies you still shamelessly not seen.
And, of course, The Joneses, which I now realise is in at number 10, which I haven't seen either.
Right, so that was pretty pointless.
It was, but, you know, that. But we did read Nigel Floyd's review of The Joneses, and he said that he liked it very much. More so than he had expected.
Okay, so we have...
The Joneses at number 10.
Number 10, well, who knows? Alice in Wonderland at 9.
There was some debate online about whether or not it was retrofitted into 3D or whether, in fact, it was planned in 3D and filmed in 2D for ease of shooting, and yadda yadda yadda, makes no odds. Short version, 2D version, good. 3D version bad.
Nanny McPhee and the Big Bangs at 8,
which I really enjoyed, and I have to say I've seen it twice now, and it was just as much fun the second time round, and good jokes about poo.
It's a Wonderful Afterlife, new entry at number 7.
I'm just confused by It's a Wonderful Afterlife. Gurinder Chadha was on the programme last week, mm-hmm. and I sat in a cinema in which people were obviously getting it a lot more than I was. I've been trying to figure out what it was that didn't work for me, and I think it comes down to this. Gurinder Chadha herself said, I'm not a horror fan, and there's so much of the film is to do with spoofing horror movies, and it may well be that you can only adequately spoof horror movies if, in the end, you are a horror fan. The second thing is, and this relates to something that she said. She said, as far as I'm concerned, what I want is it's consistent to good storytelling, consistent storytelling for the form of the movie to match the content of the movie. And I think that I just, you know, for me, the form and content did not seem to marry together. I mean, I was completely lost by most of it, but I have to confess that I sat in a room with an audience who were laughing quite a lot. So, you know, it may just be that it passed me by, but it didn't make me laugh.
The Ghost is at number 6. So some of your reviews. Ian in Oxford, ex-Prime Minister's war crimes, plot entirely plausible. Ewan McGregor's English accent, sadly not so. Vic Gibson, The Ghost is known as The Writer in Madrid. Really a traditional conspiracy film, lacking that essential ingredient, a believable conspiracy. After Shutter Island, I was left wondering if it had been some kind of homage to something, and no one had told me. Patrick McCafferty on The Ghost, I don't want to see The Ghost. It's the thing I fear the most. I'd rather have a piece of toast, which is a line from a Des Ray film, a song.
Is it?
Yes. I don't want to see The Ghost. It's the thing I fear most. I'd rather have a piece of toast. Does that work for you?
No, there was a song called Toast that was by that band called Toast.
Street Band.
Street Band.
Which is Paul Young.
Paul Young.
Oh, I could do that for a living. Mark in Birmingham, The Ghost, review, brackets short, is rubbish. Typical thriller, starts off promisingly, then all falls apart in the final reel. Ewan McGregor and Olivia Williams are very good. Kim Cattrall does the oddest accent in the history of the world. Is that short enough?
Has she seen Robin Hood?
Pardon? What?
Has he seen Robin Hood? So the oddest accent in the world.
Oh, I see. Ah, Robin Hood with our friend Russell Crowe, who
Russell Crowe.
We recorded an interview with Russell Crowe this afternoon, just before we came on air. Yeah. You will hear that on next week's programme. Next week's programme is going out on Thursday between 2 and 4. It's general election day because...
Is it next week, Thursday?
Yes.
General election?
Yes.
You know, I'd never have
noticed. Did you not know that?
It would have totally passed me by.
Because we're being moved from Friday for the pretty logical reason, actually, because it's not racing from anywhere. It's... general election results coming in thick and fast.
On the Friday.
What we're going to be doing is do our programme on Thursday, and you will hear our Russell Crowe interview then, in which, I'm delighted to say, Russell beats up Mark.
Verbally.
Verbally and inappropriately.
Inappropriately over a case of mistaken identity.
But it really is worth hanging around for, if you could just, you know, listen next Thursday between 2 and 4.
It is funny how commanding a presence he is even on the other end of an ISDN line, yes. Isn't it?
Here's the deal. He was in charge.
He was in charge.
He was in charge of the interview. Russell Crowe, Robin Hood on next week's programme. Kick-Ass is at 5.
Which I enjoyed very much. And it's nice that now the initial fuss has settled down. People can see it for what it is. I mean, it's a good inventive comic strip retelling, which I think owes more to Ghost World than it does to the Batmans. And I really liked it.
Dear John is at number 4. Lorraine Oxton in Aberdeen. You are so lucky not to have seen this film. I wish I had been so lucky. Josiah Ripley says, I never want to see you again. It's not me, it's you. dear John.
Very good.
How to Train Your Dragons, is it number three?
Good to see that it's hanging in there. You know, really good fun, really good story. Apparently very little relation to the written source, and I've seen it in both 3D and 2D, and once again, better in 2.
Clash of the Titans is at number two. Tim in Sabby Bridge. Dear Doctor and Amy Pond, re-Clash of the Titans, Titans will clash, Titania clashius, etc. The biggest problem for me wasn't the poor script, poor acting, or general lack of soul. No, the biggest problem is the name of the kingdom in peril, which you'll remember is Argus. Every reference just had me in tears as they seemed to treat the High Street catalogue store with such reverence. Who was he? He was once the mighty king of Argos. The Kraken will destroy Argos. Or the moment where the heroes land in Hades, surveyed the wasteland and asked, what is this place? To which the reply came, this is how Argos will look tomorrow. Had they found it, littered with those little pens and order sheets, I'd have paid to see it again. Hopefully the mooted sequels will feature a quest to Matalan and the rescue of the Princess of Asda. Thank you. I think that's my favourite.
Very good.
Of the week. It's very good. So Clash of the Titans still at number two, even though they've made it the most extraordinary topic really dull. Date Night is a new entry at number one.
And the problem with Date Night is that it's not as funny as it needs to be by quite a long distance. Even with the discussion about do comedy movies necessarily have to be funny, in this particular case, it needs to be funnier. The sad thing is that Steve Carell and Tina Fey in the first 10 minutes of what I thought were really good is the couple who've settled into a relationship which has sort of gone stagnant and they still have to go out on date nights but they don't really want to. And then it wants to turn into the night or after hours. And the problem with it is it very soon gets bogged down in just the mechanics of being a kind of, you know, action adventure movie, which is kind of a shame because it needs to be so much more than that. It just ceases to be funny.
It's mail at bbc.co.uk 85058. What is new, please?
Well, there's loads of stuff out. Iron Man 2 rather than Iron Man 3 is coming up, but I don't want to sort of embark upon that before we get to the half past. Can we start in that case by, just in case we haven't done it enough, reviewing Alice Creed and The Boy Called Daggs? I think it's important to do that.
Well, you're in charge at this point.
Okay, so The Experience of Alice Creed, I liked very much. And the interesting thing about it is that you've got such a stripped-down setting. I mean, often if you had a three-hander movie, you become aware of the fact that that's what you've got. For me, the strongest compliment I can give to The Disappearance of Alice Creed is that I actually wasn't aware whilst watching. I mean, I knew there was only three people in it, but I didn't think, oh, I'm watching a three-hander. I thought I'm watching a drama, which for the first 10, 15 minutes of, I felt extremely uncomfortable in. And then when it sort of started developing into something else, that was what held my attention. And it wasn't actually till I was at the very end of the movie that I went, oh, yes, that is interesting. There literally is only three people in the whole film, and that they've done that very well. They've sustained that very well without making a big deal of it. So it's, as an exercise in stripped-down, rigorous filmmaking, it really succeeds very, you know, very well. I do think that the beginning, if anything, is slightly problematic because despite what Eddie says, and I agree with him, that stuff is there to make you, you know, make you feel a certain way. I don't know whether it needed to be quite as, you know, uncomfortable as perhaps it was. I think I would have bought into the drama without some of that. I mean, do you feel the same way? Did you have any sense of discomfort about it? Because you asked Eddie, is it necessary? He said it's not gratuitous. I don't think it is gratuitous, but I wonder whether it needs to be quite as full on as it is at the beginning.
I found it disturbing enough, as I said to Eddie, to think, I hope it doesn't continue like this because otherwise, you know, I mean, I've got to watch it because Eddie was coming in and that's the job. But if I was watching it out of choice, I'd have thought, I might have made the wrong choice in getting this film or going to see this film.
But when it starts to change gear and when it moves into a different area, suddenly, you know, it does become a very, very sort of fulfilling and tense and well-written and certainly very well-directed piece. And actually, as it moves on, the way in which each of the characters develop is entirely satisfying. And what you think, what often is the problem with those kind of dramas, is that later on the drama will start to fall apart, that it won't be able to sustain itself through the whole movie. But actually, I thought it does sustain itself, and it does sustain itself very well.
And if people are going and they want to see something like Saw, then they are going to be disappointed, because it then becomes it does become a proper film.
And in the case of A Boy Called Dad, I mean, it's interesting because we first talked about A Boy Called Dad when it was showing in Edinburgh. And again, for me, all the most interesting stuff in A Boy Called Dad is the relationship stuff between Ian Hart and Carl. It is that because what you have at the centre of the film, which I think in the midst of everything else that was being said perhaps got lost in that particular interview, is that it is a film about children and fathers and absent fathers and fathers not being fathers, fathers being children, all of which, of course, is, you know, is centrally held in that title, A Boy Called Dad. And it's about what it means to be a parent and what it means to be a child and how those bonds, you know, are important and are even more important when neglected. And for me, the times that the film succeeds the best is the stuff which is based, you know, entirely in believable character study stuff, which is to do with Ian Hart and Carl's character together. Later on, the film, for reasons which I think are dramatic reasons, moves off into the area of melodrama and takes some sort of left turns in which that central relationship kind of separates and it becomes much more a sort of a fictional construct. And that's the point at which I think the movie starts to fall down. So I think it's, again, it's a case of all the stuff that's really good is the believable interaction between those two characters. And I think, if anything, I wanted more of that. And also there is some of it in which Ian Hart obviously isn't involved in the drama because of the way that drama moves. And every minute Ian Hart isn't on screen. I do think I would like Ian Hart to be on screen now, probably with Eddie Marsden, but definitely not in 3D.
Were there some, for different reasons, and we did hint at it when Carl was here, basically because he was asked directly by his grandmother's sister via an email, were there some uncomfortable moments of romantic entanglement?
Well, the whole point about the film is that what it's interested in is that cusp between childhood and adulthood. And yes, I think there are moments in it that are deliberately uncomfortable. But I also think that it's a film which is deliberately trying to confuse issues of whether somebody's a child or whether somebody's a father and whether somebody's responsible or whether somebody's irresponsible. And I do think there is a great joy in watching those performances because, I mean, you know, Ian Hart never lets you down. And I think actually Carl is a very, very talented, not so young man as he was when he made the film, obviously. Young actor.
So coming up, Iron Man 2.
We're doing before Iron Man 3 because Iron Man 3 won't make sense otherwise.
So do you want to squeeze something in before 3:30 or should we do some Iron Man 2 emails?
Do a couple of Iron Man 2 emails and
just
then I'll
to
do
tease it.
Also coming later on, we've got Valhalla Rising, we've got Erasing David, so we're going to romp through all that stuff.
We will get through that.
Yeah, we will.
Keith Howey, Dear Doctors, went to a preview screening, whatever that means, of Iron Man 2 yesterday and found it generally to be quite good fun. It zips along nicely, never really stopping to allow boredom to creep in. Towards the end, just when you think they've decided to go for an overblown, hard-to-follow climax, things get pared down into something, for a movie of this scale, a little more intimate. I'm looking forward to the DVD, though, so I can catch more than about 50% of Robert Downey Jr.'s dialogue. That low, rumbling voice is back. And worse, he conducts much of his dialogue while someone else, usually Gwyneth Paltrow, is talking over him. The movie is generally quite amusing, just about exceeding Dr. K's 5 laughs or more rule, but the comedic highlight of this movie-going experience was before the film even started, when during the trailers, and a number of people have pointed this out, the audience turned into a room full of sniggering Beavis and Buttheads when those three immortal words, "The Last Airbender," flashed up. I refer you to previous programmes.
Yes.
To think all the money spent on this movie and no one has worked out that it needs to have its title changed. The Last Airbender, clearly merely moments away.
And there was a... Because Last Airbender was going to be called Avatar, but unfortunately James Cameron called his movie Avatar. I'd like to have seen James Cameron make the biggest selling movie of all time had he called it The Last Airbender.
Sam in London, what are the odds that Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow listened to the Mayo and Kermode podcast? They seem to have studied Dr. K's impressions of them, since, to an even greater degree than the first film, every conversation they have in Iron Man 2 consists purely of Mrs. Paltrow whining at Mr. Downey in an exasperated soprano while he rumbles on in his growly baritone. Like most modern sequels, Iron Man 2 is basically the first film multiplied exponentially. There were more characters running around and shouting for a longer period of time before a conclusion where instead of Iron Man fighting a robot, two Iron Men fight
many robots.
Insensitive depictions of foreigners, Mickey Rourke outclassed the first film's clownish Arabs by portraying a typical Russian, a vodka-swilling thug called Ivan, whose only dialogue is to grunt in monosyllables and then cackle loudly. It was all loud and flashy enough to count as a success, but I have to question the film's political message, which was likewise amplified. In the first film, all Iron Man did was invade an unspecified Middle Eastern nation and kill a lot of foreigners. Here, he had a bunch of drone robots impose a US-sponsored peace on the world. Did the filmmakers really think that would play well?
That is the best line in the film when he says, "I have privatised world peace."
Could you please tell the good doctor not to do his Russell Crowe impression again, at least not so close to the microphone? It sent shivers down my spine, says Rachel in Leeds.
Russell Crowe.
No, he said, don't do it again.
Oh, I said, do it again.
Penelope, on this, I was an extra in Clash of the Titans. and had a terrible job keeping a straight face when Hades said he was going to destroy Argos. I thought I was the only one. By the way, Gemma Arterton was delightful, pleasant, cheerful and kind.
Yeah, that's which is interesting because, of course, one of the other things about Disappearance of Alice Creed is you know, it's
where
not,
she plays Alice Creed.
In which she plays Alice Creed. It is a side of her that I had not seen before, and I was very impressed. And, you know, it's certainly a far more substantial role than I've seen her in before.
Rick in Somerset, the Alice Creed film sounds good. I just mentioned it to my brother, who went off on a rant about our local Cineworld not showing it, but showing Smiley Virus and Clash of the Titans instead. I hope he calms down soon. So we've heard what some correspondents think about Iron Man 2. Here's what Dr. Kamen
said. Let's say first and foremost, there was the question in that email about the preview screening, whatever that is. This is now become common practice that what you do is you open your movie on a Wednesday or a Thursday in order to, or the weekend before, in order to up the first box office weekend's takings. Because when it says, you know, box office takings over the weekend, they take that from the date of the official release, and you effectively take all the money that it's made up until this. So it's simply a way of fixing the box office. So the reviews will come out Friday, the film officially opens Friday, but the film may have played in a cinema Saturday, Sunday before, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and you don't have to be a genius to realise that it is just a way of pushing your box office up in the opening weekend, because as we know nowadays, opening weekend is in itself the story. Something has to make a certain amount of money in the opening weekend, otherwise the trade papers say it's dead in the water. And I mean, it's terrifying how that has happened. It means that nothing has the chance to grow and establish itself like it used to. Anyway, from that on to Iron Man 2. So the main issue with the first Iron Man was that you had a kind of disparity between, on the one hand, the characters who were kind of interesting in a funny and snappy and comic way, and on the other hand, the hardware. So it was like there was two movies going on. One of them was the movie in which Robert Downey Jr. goes and goes, and Jeff Bridges comes on, and then at the end it turns into they both put on the suit, and the minute they put on the suit and start hitting each other, I'm not so interested anymore, because that's just like Transformers, only not quite Transformers.
Isn't that what everyone else is waiting for, though?
Well, obviously, if you're going to see a film called Iron Man, there is a certain amount of I would like to, you'd be hard-pressed,
a man made of iron.
Yes, you'd be hard-pressed to make the movie that I would want to see, which is the movie in which Robert Downey Jr. never puts on the suit, but literally just sits there going... Anyway, so the story this time is, so successful has the Iron Man suit become that the Americans have decided that, in fact, it is a weapon that must be handed over to the American government. He doesn't want to cooperate. As he says, I mentioned before, he says, I've successfully privatised world peace. Meanwhile, his argument for why he is okay looking after the weapon, he says it's a suit, they say it's a weapon, is because nobody else has technology that is in any way comparable, therefore it's not like anybody else could take over this technology. Little does he know that Mickey Rourke, as an evil Ruski, Ivan, is, even as he speaks, developing his own Iron Man suit, because it turns out that Mickey Rourke's father, in the past, was involved in the original design of Iron Man. Here's a clip.
You come from a family of thieves and butchers, and now, like all guilty men, try to rewrite your own history. And you forget all the lives the Stark family has destroyed.
Speaking of thieves, where did you get this design?
My father, Anton Vanko.
Well, I never heard of him.
My father is the reason you're alive.
The reason I'm alive is because you had a shot, you took it, you missed.
Did I?
So, from then on, you understood what was going on in that clip, didn't you?
No, I had no idea at all.
Well, Mickey, didn't I explain it and set it up? Mickey Rourke is the Ruski.
Yeah, I got that bit.
Yeah, and it turns out that his father was basically done over, which is what he's claiming, by Robert Downey Jr.'s father. He was involved in the original blueprint, and now he wants the suit back. So now, at the beginning of the movie, the thing, it's directed by Jon Favreau, who you'll remember, of course, was the actor who we first got to know through Swingers and Maid, you know, with Vince Vaughn. Subsequently turned out, you know who he is.
Yeah,
you do. You've seen him in Couples Retreat. You can picture Jon Favreau.
I couldn't. If I bumped into him, I wouldn't know him.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway,
describe him to me. What's he look like?
Just, well, I was going to say he's the larger gentleman.
Yeah.
He's middle-aged.
Yeah. What's he look like?
He looks like... he looks not unlike James Gandolfini.
Oh, okay.
Okay, fine. So, but if you go up to James Gandolfini and say you're Jon Favreau, you're in trouble. And the beginning of the movie is directed in a way that was very sort of snappy and funny, and basically was all characters talking over each other in a... which was dialogue heavyweight. And it was literally... and then every now and then we'd stop and we'd go over to Mickey Rourke. I am Ruski. I am Mickey Rourke. I have funny facial hair. I haven't quite decided how to do my beard. And there is a couple of moments. Incidentally, if you're watching Iron Man, watch Mickey Rourke's hair and glasses for glaring continuity errors, because it's clear that even on a big budget movie like this, and I know there've been talks about reshoots, it has been impossible to make continuity with Mickey Rourke's facial hair and glasses arrangement, because he has what can only be described as anarcho hair. I mean, it's not like the hair on his head seems to grow out of the normal part of his body. It's like, it's just peculiar. It's a strange thing. Anyway, so at the beginning of it, there's all the character-driven stuff, which I like, and it's funny and it's witty, and Robert Downey Jr. somehow has grabbed hold of this role of this character who's got all these resources and is very intelligent, but is also very flippant and, you know, is enjoying himself much too much, and he's doing it very well. However, there is this kind of behemoth coming up behind him, which is the sense that this is Iron Man 2, and what you're going to need, therefore, is special effects climaxes. And about halfway through the film, you get this great big special effects set pieces involving Formula One race cars and battling suits and effectively what are, you know, modern day lightsabers. It's Mickey Rourke's character has these strings of electricity which he swishes around and cuts cars, you know, in half with. And that's fine. But as the movie continues, and it's quite a long movie, the law of diminishing returns starts to apply, and it starts to more and more turn into the great big hardware movie that I don't want it to be. But that said, even whilst it was being a great big hardware movie, the hardware is directed with a certain amount of, you know, vim. Characters come and then disappear and then go away and then turn up, and then Scarlett Johansson's character turns up purely, it seems to me, for the, you know, for the purpose of being Scarlett Johansson and turning up and kicking some butt and then looking, you know, kind of hot and like Scarlett Johansson and then disappearing off again. And then there's a character that turns up, which is Samuel Jackson, who's sort of there and he sort of is there. The whole thing starts to fall apart, but what the time at which it works is the scenes which have Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow, and I have to say occasionally the scenes with him and Mickey Rourke, in which they are characters talking across each other, snapping at each other, crabbing at each other, being prickly with each other, being funny with each other, in which the script is written in a way which belies the fact that it is in the end a great big blockbuster franchise movie. So overall, it is all over the place, and as the movie progresses, it is increasingly all over the place. It starts at a level of conversation and escalates to a level of shouting and explosions and throwing everything at the screen because we can. At its best, it has a small number of... I mean, I haven't even mentioned the Sam Rockwell character. At its best, it has a small number of characters. At its worst, it has more characters than it knows how to deal with. And you think, for example, of what happened with the Spider-Man movies, in which suddenly there are characters that they have to bring in. Oh, we haven't had that guy in for a while. To bring him in. So it rambles and it's incoherent and it's messy and it's shambolic, and it is in the end
a bit like this program,
a pile up, but an enjoyable pile up. And enjoyable because at the heart of all the hardware and all the special effects and all the stuff, there is Robert Downey Jr. going and Gwyneth Paltrow going, and I still like that gag.
Clearly, whether anyone else does, I suspect...
No, I meant I like the gag in the film, not I like my gag about it.
Pierce in Dublin. Dear Simon and Flappy Hand, saw Iron Man 2 yesterday, about as interesting as throwing a toaster around the room while mumbling in a charismatic manner. At least if it was in 3D, I could have fallen asleep behind the dark glasses.
Yeah, so people have said that that's what the best thing about 3D is, that you can do that.
Ariane in Glasgow. Dear Cogsworth and Lumiere, watching for the first time on live streaming today and loving it. Just noticed when Dr. K did his ever-so-accurate impression of Gwyneth Paltrow. Please don't encourage him. He seemed to do some sort of air guitar movement with his hands, which aren't as big and flappy as I was expecting.
What was the air guitar movement? No, which...
No, you do a lot of this. You do a lot of kind of slightly camp arm waving, which can look like air guitar.
Can I just suggest that you calling me camp, pot, kettle...
John in Bradford... Pearl and Dean, I went to see Iron Man 2 last night. I enjoyed the first instalment.
Oh, no, fine, but didn't enjoy the rest of it.
Apart from the last 20 minutes or so, and went with an open mind to this one. I've been struggling to like it or hate it. Gwyneth Paltrow simpered and whimpered her way through the whole film. The banter between her and Robert Downey Jr. was annoying beyond belief.
No, it's not. It's funny.
And it got to the stage where I was struggling to follow what was actually being said. I never got the impression that Whiplash really hated Tony Stark enough to want to destroy him. The film jumped here, there and everywhere far too much.
It is all over the place, and it needs to be half an hour shorter, and it does look like it's been substantially reshot or re-edited or restructured, as is the case with so many of these things.
Neil on this, in fact it's Neil Barnett, Dr. Thing and Dr. Thingy. My review of Iron Man 2. What a cliché-filled, loud bore. I really liked the first Iron Man film. What a disappointment the sequel is. The biggest miscast was Sam Rockwell. Such a weak performance. Oh, and watch out for the scenes where Sam's palms are nice mahogany colour. He should have used gloves when self-tanning. Love the show, Steve, says Neil. Now, time for a couple more movies. We're yet to announce the movie of the week, but first of all, Valhalla Rising.
Well, Valhalla Rising is a new film by Nick Winding Refn, who's because he's the guy who did the Pusher trilogy and Bronson most recently, which was quite a controversial film, and Fear X, which I like very much because wasn't seen by many people. This is an epic adventure, and it owes something visually, I think, to Centurion. I mean, not influenced by, but it's similar to, in its look, to Centurion. Although the thing it reminded me of the most, and I'm not the only person to say this, is The Navigator, the Vincent Ward film. It is a 12th century epic starring Mads Mikkelsen, who is a sort of a fighter figure who makes a strange and epic journey from Scotland to a new world, which we're not entirely sure where it is. It's a mythical world. And essentially, what it's a film about is, rather than it being a film about a plot, it is a film about lone figures trudging over incredible landscapes with enormous cloud formations brooding, ominous. I mean, it's kind of Titans Will Clash sort of stuff, with great big epochal overtones and a sense of people, you know, what's called Valhalla Rising. I mean, you know who Valhalla, obviously, because if you listen to Led Zeppelin, Valhalla I Am Coming. So it is essentially big men with swords striding across huge landscapes, not saying very much, occasionally hitting each other in the face with large pieces of hardware, and in doing so, coming into contact with some kind of heroic epic battle. And here's what I think. It's not for everybody by quite a long way, and it is...
Who is it not for?
It's not for people who like snappy dialogue. It's not for people who like things to move along a pace. It's not for people who think, yes, this is all mood, but where's the plot? If, however, like me, you've got a bit of a soft spot for Nick Winding Refn and think that he has a way of making a shot visually interesting for perhaps longer than the narrative would assume that you would stay there, then I think it's worthwhile. I mean, I think it's got a very, very small theatrical audience, and it's going to come out on DVD pretty soon. But he does have a way of doing atmospherics. He does have a way of doing mighty atmospherics. I was thinking about it because Centurion is out in the cinema at the moment, and Centurion costs so little money to make comparatively, and yet, regardless of whether you think it's a great film, and I think I like it more than you do, it does still have an epic visual sweep. And Valhalla Rising, I mean, Nick Winding Refn knows how to make things look epic. And as I said, I said it reminded me of The Navigator, the Vincent Ward movie. I mean, that's not something that I would say casually, because I think Navigator is this isn't incidentally as good as Navigator, but it does have that same sense of portentous atmosphere, of brooding clouds, of something metaphysical happening within the rock faces, although I'm not entirely sure what.
Has Valhalla been descending? Is that the implication, that it has had better times, but now it's back and it's rising again?
I'm sure that you could read it like that. Now, we have several other movies
is
to
that
get
how
through.
You read it?
No, I just read it as Valhalla Rising, in the same way as Lucifer Rising.
Okay.
Can I do the last song? Because we've had this thing about Dear John, and it's the Smiley Virus film.
The last song.
I don't want to not do it.
Make sure you fit it in before we get on to anything else.
Okay, last song, which is the new, which is already somebody has made the Smiley Virus joke. This is the new movie based on novel by Nicholas Sparks, who is apparently incredibly successful and is responsible for the novel upon which Dear John is based. The story is that Miley Cyrus is the daughter of a divorced parentage. She has been with her mother. She has been causing her mother terrible trouble. She is now going to stay with her father for a certain amount of time. Now, see whether, from the clip that I'm going to play you, which sets up a few little things, see whether you can figure out how the whole of the rest of the film plays out. Okay, here's the clip.
You rehearsed that piece with her so many times.
Is she still not playing?
Not since the day you left.
How is she otherwise?
Well, let's see. Grades were in the toilet. It's a miracle she graduated from high school. And she doesn't have one friend without a pierced something. Thanks.
No.
She told you she got into Juilliard, right?
No. Without playing?
They said they've been watching her since she was 5. Not that it matters. She says she's not going.
Well, she'll make the right decision.
I'm glad you're so sure.
Now, add to this the fact that it is soon revealed that the father spent some time in hospital, but he's all right now. Okay?
But is he coughing?
No, he's all right now.
Okay.
So,
that's good. Good to
the
know.
Key coordinates that you have here are She's a troubled kid, estranged from her father, who's such a brilliant musician that she got into Juilliard despite the fact that she no longer plays the piano since her estranged father left. She's got into Juilliard, but she's not going. But they're going to spend the summer together. Now, on the basis of that, which of the following things do you think may happen? Mm-hmm. Do you think she'll reconcile with her father? I'm asking you, this is not rhetorically. Do you think during the course of the movie she'll reconcile with her father?
Yeah.
Do you think that there may be reconciliation with music going along with that?
Inevitably.
Do you think that she might perhaps want to move towards a position in which she does take up that offer of a place at Juilliard?
It's quite likely.
And do you think Dad's going to make it to the final reel? Okay.
Well, I think we should leave that hanging.
Nicholas Sparks himself says there's a lot of themes in the last song. You've got faith.
But you said he was all right, so obviously he does make it to the final reel.
Who said he was all right?
You did.
He said he was all right, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. That's so right. He makes it to the final reel. Because that's how it works in film. And people go, I'm all right.
I'm better.
Yeah. you've got faith, forgiveness, family. If you just get these right, these are themes that touch viewers because they recognise them in their own lives. Now, here's the interesting conflict going on in my head about last song, okay? On the one hand, it's pants, right? Obviously. However, I would be lying if I didn't tell you that I actually sat there. Even as she turns up on the beach, there's a guy, he's running around with no shirt on, he's incredibly buff, you know, he hates her, she doesn't like him, are they going to become friends? He's incredibly rich, do you think he'll be able to reconcile with her? Don't know. Father, played by Greg Kinnear, who I like, I mean, I could honestly watch Greg Kinnear in almost anything. He's wants to, you know, wants things to be okay with his daughter, she ready to, do I think things are going to be all right? And there are some turtle eggs. There are some turtle eggs which are buried in the sand, which at some crucial moment in the movie might actually give birth, and therefore, you know, even as life goes this way, life also goes this way. And I would be lying if I didn't say, even as every atom of my being went schmaltz, 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 you're being put up, I welled up, I started, no, sorry, and I was sitting there thinking, you know what? I know that people have this idea that somehow this movie is completely constructed. Of course it is, and the Nicholas Sparks is nothing but a... But I have a suspicion that if I sat down and read a Mills and Boone novel, it might work in the same way. But I did not find myself unresponsive to the themes addressed in the movie, even as my gag reflex was struggling to be suppressed.
And your internal waterwork system working overload already.
Yeah, I kind of thought that there were things in it that were... I mean, I even though I know what's wrong with it, it was efficiently enough put together. And at the heart of it is the fact that I will buy into almost anything if Greg Kinnear tells me to do so. He's one of those really interesting actors that it doesn't matter how much kind of chocolate sauce he's swimming around in, I still buy Greg Kinnear. So, yes... Obviously, the target audience for this movie is not the people who are going to send emails in next week saying, I went to see it and it was terrible, because it's not like Dear John, it's playing a lot younger than that. It's a Smiley Virus film, okay? But you know what? The Smiley Virus audience might well like it.
Was it Stephen Fry who thought that joke up? I mean, he said it on this programme, and we thought, oh, that's very good, we'll use that.
Well, I thought it was him, but I mean, maybe
not.
Well,
let's assume that it is. And hello to Stephen, should he still be with us. Hello to Jason, because he'll be with us somewhere. And hello to David, David Morrissey, you mentioned already, and
yes.
Ian Hart mentioned him, and you mentioned Centurion
yes.
just a while back. Which
There's
is,
more films to do, incidentally, but carry
yeah,
on.
Okay, no, it's just outside the top ten. I just wanted to mention this from James McAndrew. I had the pleasure of enjoying Neil Marshall's latest love letter to Scotland in a near-deserted mid-afternoon screening of Centurion, and while I thought it was a terrific return to form for Marshall after the somewhat silly and underwhelming Doomsday...
I like Doomsday!
I did find two major disappointments with it. Firstly, the BBFC declaration of the film having a 15 certificate. I fear the BBFC are becoming desensitised to Marshall's trademark tongue-in-cheek guts and gore. How many heads do you have to lop off these days to get an 18? And secondly, was there nowhere in the script to squeeze in a cameo for Sean Pertwee to give one of his staple gruesome death scenes? Apart from that, I commend Mr. Marshall on a thoroughly entertaining historical film. So, but Centurion is about number 13 at the moment. What else is new?
Two things. Gentleman Broncos, which is the new film by Jared Hess, who was the guy who made a splash with Napoleon Dynamite years and years ago and then went on to make Nacho Libre. Do you remember Nacho Libre? Sometimes a man in his room must wear stretchy pants. Remember that?
I don't think I saw Nacho Libre.
Oh, really? Well,
based on your review,
No, Nacho Libre was quite funny. So So the story in Gentleman Broncos is that there is a young kid who writes science fiction stories. He writes a series of science fiction stories, and the one that he's most proud of is called Yeast Lords. That's yeast lords.
Mm, scary.
He then goes on a writer's camp in which he meets Ronald Chevalier, who is a science fiction author played by your man there out of Flight of the Conchords, whose name is Jermaine Clement, you know, who's very, very good science fiction author, and who then steals his story and, you know, behaves badly. And it's one of those very peculiar films in which there's a certain amount of quirky, goofy... Do you remember that? Do you remember Napoleon Dynamite?
Yes.
Okay, do you remember the scene in Napoleon Dynamite when your main man meets somebody else who has a bike and he says, "Oh, sweet bike. You ever do any sweet jumps on it?" And then it cuts to a scene of him attempting to do a jump falling over. And that's basically the gag. It's dorky to the max. Well, the thing with Gentlemen Broncos is that within the sort of the chaos of the movie itself, which I think has been around for a little while, there is about 20, 25, 30 minutes of good, dorky, sci-fi related oddness. The bizarre thing is that it's a full-length feature film that consequently ends up sorely tiring the patience, because you think, yeah, well, if you did this as a thing that's the same length, for example, as an episode of Flight of the Conchords, you might have got away with this. But unfortunately, you're trying to stretch this level of strange, kooky weirdness out far. And as I've said before, a little bit of kooky and a little bit of quirky goes an awfully long way. So it's not that it was without charm, but it was certainly without enough charm to sustain a movie. And finally, Erasing David, which is a documentary in which a journalist decides to find out what happens if you attempt to disappear for a month, on the basis that wherever we go, we are leaving digital trails, and, you know, everyone can find out everything about us by making a phone call, ring up the National Health, ringing up our banks, you know, going back to our birth records. And it basically demonstrates what I think most of us are already aware of, is that we live in a surveillance culture. Apparently in the UK, we are more surveilled than almost anybody else in the entire universe. But the problem with the documentary is it has to be sort of tense and perhaps more action-packed than the story itself deserves, which is simply, wherever you go, whatever you do, they're watching you, nothing you can do about it. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Movie of the week.
Well, I think The Disappearance of Alice Creed.
Next week, we're on Thursday. It's May the 6th. It's general election day. We're moving there because Friday might be busy, what with results coming
and
in.
And everything.
Up. And Russell Crowe will be our guest. We have spoken
Russell Crowe.
And he beats up Mark verbally and inappropriately. And you can hear it next Thursday. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.